Welcome to the Show Me the Money panel. These are our, these are our money men. So I will, we didn't do name tags here, unfortunately, so I will give a quick introduction to everyone on the panel. We will go through, I'll go through a couple slides that I think are good backdrop for anybody who doesn't deal with everything from debt and equity investments on a daily basis, interest rates, and then we will transition into a bunch of panel discussion and Q&A, hopefully from the audience as well. So first next to me, Rafi Killian is with Heitman's Real Estate Debt Group, vice president there, originates, structures, mezzanine and senior debt across every real estate sector, certainly including office and industrial. Last year originated over $200 million in real estate loans, and before that he was with their European acquisitions group. And we should talk about the London conference too then. And has done over did over 500 million euros of transactions out throughout Central Europe across multiple property types. We will primarily focus on office for this group, but we're going to talk a little bit about industrial as well. We won't keep it strictly to the office world. Rafi got his BS in civil engineering from the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, so he's locally educated and grown, and an MBA from the Olin School of Business at Washington U in St. Louis. Welcome, Rafi Killian. Thanks. Tim Walsh is a principal and investment officer with the core portfolio, primarily of industrial, with Exeter Property Group, is responsible for capital deployment, portfolio construction, and asset management within that group. As part of what Exeter does, a lot of you, they are one of our sponsors and exhibitors. We appreciate that. They do primarily industrial, a few other things along the way.
We do some office as well.
So, and Tim is with their core group, which is the stable investment return side, and is here talking not just about equity in general, but also about the very stable kind of markets and where they invest. Next to him is Matt Haley, managing principal of Pearlmark, based here locally in Chicago. Pearlmark does equity and debt, mezzanine debt, pref equity, a variety of different pieces of the capital stack. And Mr. Haley has been involved in over $5 billion of transactions in his time at Pearlmark. Before that, he was with LaSalle Partners, JMB, and KPMG Pete Marwick. Next to him, a lot of you know Peter Drake from our Bank of America team, one of our big sponsors, our premier sponsor. We appreciate very greatly. Peter has been with Bank of America for 25 years, 20 years plus in their business banking division, focuses on small and middle markets, and is speaking specifically about something that a lot of us don't talk maybe enough about, and that is the unique ways that user financing can be used. And SBA 504 program and other things like that, which for those of you who don't realize what our Bank of America Merrill Lynch sponsor group does, that is actually what their group primarily focuses on within the bank. Peter. And on the end, Rob Weil, principal with JDI Realty, based here in Chicago, focuses on both debt and equity, including mezzanine and preferred equity investments. Rob has done over $1 billion of real estate investments since he joined JDI in 2003. They also do discounted real estate note acquisitions, and maybe we can touch on that briefly. Not a lot of people in here maybe have done much of that. And prior to JDI, he was a senior vice president with Builders Bank in Chicago, and also with Claff Realty, for those of you who know that name here locally in Chicago. Graduated from Emory University, and also has a JD from Northwestern School of Law. So that is our panel. And how many in this room do some kind of investment sales or debt equity placement, anything beyond just leasing? How many? Okay. How many people in this room think interest rates are going to go up in the next 12 months? It's not as many hands as I actually thought. You guys are kind of bearish on that. Let me go to a slide here for a second. How many people in this room thinks interest rates are going to go up 50 basis points or less on, let's say, the U.S. Treasury, 10-year Treasury, 50 basis points or less in the next 12 months? 50 basis points or more in the next 12 months? One, two. All right. So not many people think rates are going up very far. So interestingly, that's actually part of my first slide, which is when you look around the world at the other indices that our U.S. Treasuries compete for investment dollars with, as much as I think our Federal Reserve would kind of like to start to inch our interest rates upward, one of the market polls against that, and one of the reasons why anybody who is overly concerned with interest rate rise in the next 12 months or 24 months, I think, might be wrong, is that the other major countries in the world for the same kind of debt are much, much lower returning already. If you look at Japan, that has been significantly below most of the major countries for a lot of years. But if you look at Canada, the UK, and Germany, historically Canada and the UK have actually had slightly higher interest rates than us. Now they're lower. And Germany has recently seen its interest rates plunge. So it's kind of hard to imagine to me that the U.S. interest rates are going to go up significantly, because the moment they start to creep up, buyers start buying our debt because they make a lot more return than they make in Germany or England. This is a very global marketplace, and I think that will prevent a significant amount of interest rate rise. Another thing that some of us were talking about this morning, I think we all should want to see our interest rates go up. I know a lot of years people have said, no, let's hope it doesn't. If interest rates don't go up at some point here, I'm not sure what the Federal Reserve would be able to do if we have another recession, or I guess when we have another recession. It's a very cyclical business. It's a cyclical economy. And if we don't have some way to try to counteract that at the Fed, there's not much we can do. And so, as the slide says, the Fed has no gas in the tank. When interest rates are this low, I'm not sure where you're supposed to take them. So I think it's important for all of us and our economy and those that try to tinker with the major impacts on it that they have some ability to do that. Oh, before I show that slide, how many people in this room think that if interest rates go up significantly, that cap rates will follow? How many people think that if interest rates go up significantly, cap rates will remain steady? Fall? Anyone? No, I didn't think anybody was going to say that. Interestingly, as interest rates go up historically, the data says that cap rates do not. And that is counterintuitive to some of us. We think if your cost of debt goes up, then somehow you must get a higher return. But remember, cap rates reflect just a point in time, and that's your NOI in a building today, not your NOI for the next 5 or 10 years. And so to the extent that we see interest rates going up historically, usually that's because we have a good economy. If we have a good economy, that's when we see rental rates go up. So people can pay lower cap rates today for the future of increased rent tomorrow. So historically, the NCREIF property index says that, in fact, cap rates don't rise when interest rate rises occur. So people in this room shouldn't be scared if our interest rates go up. I don't think that's going to hurt your cap rates. And then the last slide I'll show, for those of you that don't do lending much, you might not have focused on this, but in the 2006-2007 wave of high transaction activity, there was significant lending activity, and there is a huge wave of maturities on all those loans that were 10-year loans, 2006-2007. They all come up in 2016 and 2017. So one of the questions for some of our panelists is going to be about what happens when all of a sudden all of this debt comes due in the next 2 years. And if you look at that graph, 2016 and 17 are huge anomalies compared to every other year we've had, and frankly, every year we have to come right now. So with that, our panelists, let's start to discuss it. Peter, I want to start with you, if I can, for the benefit of those who aren't familiar with 504 lending, user-based financing on buildings, can you give everybody a bit of a perspective to understand what your group does nationally at B of A and how you finance things for users as opposed to the way most of us talk about it, which is for investors?
Great. Thanks, Gabriel. It's great being here. And we've got our team here. We've got John Manganiello in the back, my boss, Scott Kelly, who runs Atlanta. We've got Rick Benito, who runs our SBA group nationally. Ben Tahir, who's from Atlanta. And we got Ryan and Garcia. They're both our SBA experts. So it's great. We got a great team here. So hope to meet you all at our booth later. But yeah, Bank of America, we're from our business banking group. We finance primarily small to medium-sized companies. Companies are anywhere from about $5 million to $50 million or so in sales. And primarily focusing on either conventional financing. We can finance up to 80% conventional for those businesses that are going to occupy 51% of the building, and that would be office, warehouse, retail, storefront. And then we also do the SBA 504 loan program. The SBA 504 loan program is a program where you can buy a building with as little as 10% down. The way that works is the Bank of America would finance 50% as a first trustee. Then the SBA, through what's called a CDC, or Certified Development Company, it's a nonprofit. There's about 250 of them around the country. They handle all the paperwork on behalf of the Small Business Administration. They'll finance 40% of the project. So you got the client that in the end is going to get two loans, a loan from Bank of America, a loan through the SBA, and then they're going to come in with 10% down. This program is a great program because rates right now are very favorable for the SBA 504 program. Just as an example, the SBA rate actually went down today. There's 20-year rate, which is, it's 20 years fully amortizing. It's 4.76 for 20-year money fully amortizing. And the Bank of America offers a bunch of different programs. But as an example, as of today, we're probably pricing somewhere around 2 over the 10-year Treasury bill for a 10-year fixed rate that resets after the first 10 years, and that's amortized over 25. The rate on that is going to be somewhere in the 4.6 range. So the 10-year Treasury today is, believe it or not, 2.07, which you asked me a year ago, I would have thought the rate would have been closer to 3% as a testament to where rates are. We also do SBA 7A program. That's a program where you can finance 90% of the building, and the SBA is our guarantor. They guarantee up to 75% of the loan, and you can actually find a 25-year fixed rate fully amortized program using the SBA 7A program, and that rate is going to be somewhere in the mid fours right now. The 504 program, a lot of people think it's only for small deals, but we've done transactions upwards of $20 million. You can get 90% financing pretty easily for up to $12 million or so. We just need to finance a larger percentage, like 60, 65% of the first trustee amount to get to the larger percentages up to that $20 million range or so. But we're doing much larger transactions right now. In terms of eligibility, the business owner needs to be a U.S. citizen or a resident alien. The company can't have a net worth of greater than $15 million and can't have consecutive profit for the last 2 years of $5 million. So that opens up a pretty wide spectrum to some pretty large companies. We see $100 million companies now using the SBA 504 program to buy a building. In the past, we'd actually seen some of the larger companies want to get the 504 program, but they were overqualified because, quite frankly, the terms are even somewhat better than you might find on conventional financing, getting 90% financing with a fixed rate in the high fours. So the SBA's also just recently reduced the fee. They were charging 2.65% on the second trustee portion, which is financed into the balance of the loan. They actually dropped that another 0.5%. So it's now 2.15 financed into the balance of the second. So the SBA is really trying to be aggressive, trying to get out there and make more loans to the owner user. And we're looking forward to talking to you about it. In addition, we'll do conventional financing up to 80% too for those clients that want to put a little bit more down as well.
And Peter, do they have to be entirely user occupied, or can you have other tenants in your building? Just what do you have a break point at which you can no longer use that kind of financing as a user?
The building needs to be at least 51% or more owner occupied. Okay. So you can have a tenant in the building as long as you're going to occupy, the business owner is going to occupy 51% of the property itself. Okay. And I know we've done a lot of properties in New York for pretty large dollars for some of these high-rise buildings where they'll occupy a whole floor for a garment company or other. We've done a lot of those too. So,
okay. Rob, let me go to you. You are one of a, not a new hybrid, but at JDI, but the debt fund world to me has kind of really taken a new prominence in lending in the last, since the last downturn. And filled a huge gap in the market when there was a liquidity crisis with what we think of as traditional lenders. And as opposed to kind of disappearing then as the regular world came back, you guys are still around. Some of your counterparts are raising bigger funds now than they ever have done. Can you talk for a second about what is a debt fund the way we think of it? Why is there an advantage? And how do you see the debt fund players in the space today as lenders?
Sure. First, I should say the debt fund that, you know, there's lots of different kinds of debt funds that play in all different parts of kind of the capital stack and the risk spectrum. Where my company operates is kind of further out on the risk spectrum. We're more of a hard money, private money lender. And what I guess the observation I could make was post 2008 in the, you know, 9, 10, 11, we were really one of the only, you know, options out there for people that were doing deals. So we were doing very mainstream deals and charging double digit interest rates and points. And we were doing what you would consider vanilla bankable deals because the banks weren't lending unless you had, you know, pristine everything. Since that time and over the last couple of years, the debt marketplace has become incredibly crowded. And there have been all sorts of new players that have, you know, come up that are occupying spaces and lending money in deals that I think, you know, maybe pre 2008 banks would have done because it got a little crazy in 2005, 6, and 7. But prior to that, these are types of deals that, you know, you would have had to go to a private lender that was going to charge you a lot of money. So an example is right now where my company is buying a shopping center in Atlanta that we bid at an auction, and it's a retail shopping center, and we have to close in 30 days. No estoppels are available, and we're buying it from the lender. So it's kind of a, you know, we're comfortable with it, but it's kind of a dicey proposition from a lender's standpoint. We're getting a loan from a big debt fund where they're loaning us 65% of our acquisition price. They're loaning us 80% of TIs and leasing commissions, and they're charging us 5%. So to me, that's like that's a crazy loan. You know, that's I don't think the risk is priced appropriately, but we'll take advantage of it. And so the point there is there's so much money in the debt world right now that if you have a property that's in a place or property type where the lenders are looking to do business, they're aggressively trying to do business. You know, conversely, and I know we'll get to this later, if you have something in a place, you know, a smaller city or a property type where lenders aren't as interested, it's a much harder go. That answer?
That's great. Do you see, you mentioned smaller cities having a different kind of competitive landscape. Is that a place that you find you aren't running into as much competition when you're being a lender?
Sure, but it's the issue becomes, you know, most of my debt deals are deals that have to happen quickly. And so if I get a debt deal in, you know, Atlanta, I know the 12 people I have to call to kind of triangulate on what that deal is all about. If someone calls and says, I have a deal in Montana, I don't know who I should call. So it's a much harder thing for me to say, you know, to get comfortable that I'm making a good decision. You can only learn so much by going, you know, and spending a day or two in the market. You can't, you know, obviously absorb everything there is to absorb about a particular asset class or a particular market. There's things that, you know, you need to talk to the locals for.
Alan Gump would have me say, if you go on the SIOR website under search for an SIOR,
right,
you'll find a local market guy. Matt, you guys do some of the same stuff that Rob does a little bit. You do some traditional, what I think of as traditional mezz and pref equity lending. How would you differentiate that kind of space versus what Rob does and the difference between lending first dollar all the way up versus starting already high up in the stack and how you evaluate that.
Well, where we go in the stack on our mezzanine debt funds, we're only going to go up to about 85% of value. And these are generally less risky, more institutional quality assets than what JDI will finance. Mm-hmm. We differentiate typically by sponsor, asset type, and the amount of equity coming into it.
Okay. One of the Peter Linneman is going to be our speaker on Saturday morning for those of you who make it out of bed for the closing general session after tomorrow night's events. Peter likes to put up at the end of all his presentations a thing he calls the canaries in the coal mine, which are kind of the signs that there's another pending apocalypse here coming to our real estate industry. And one of the things that is one of his canaries is he describes it as is lenders lending, senior debt lenders taking over the mezzanine piece in the stack and kind of running the mezz guys out and just lending all the way up to your 85%. Are you getting squeezed on those deals right now where senior lenders are doing that? Are you seeing senior lenders still stay disciplined and they want you to come in for that piece?
No, I think senior lenders are still remaining disciplined. What we have seen this year are a couple things. You'll have a debt fund or someone, even a bank, who can do the entire stack, go up to 85, then they'll hold the sell off the A piece, the senior piece, and hold them as themselves. Mm-hmm. And we've seen a couple times where a bank will provide 85, and we typically go 70 to 85. They go up to 85, but they'll have the sponsor, the equity, take back recourse down to about 60%. So effectively, they're just getting equity to replace their last up to 85% of value on the financing. Now, I'm shocked by that people are taking recourse again, because our mezz is certainly cheaper than the sponsor's equity, or it should be. And that's where we've been squeezed a couple times. I don't think lenders are taking more risk at this point.
Is replacing equity the primary motivation you find for people using mezzanine debt?
Yes, we're just filling in, right? The stack is, you know, $100. The senior's gonna come in at 60. The other 40 has to come from somewhere. We're just the financing between that and the equity.
Do you see that your borrowers then are using you primarily because your return rate will continue to further improve their IRR, or are they using it because they just don't have that 30 or 40%?
Both. We have to fill that in, because it's a fair amount of dollars for a lot of sponsors to come up with, and it certainly enhances on the computer screen, enhances their returns.
Okay. It's a good point about the computer screen. I have yet to find a deal in a pro forma that didn't work. Rafi, we're talking about going high in the capital stack. You will structure deals that way, actually. You will go, at least on some deals, all the way up from zero to, call it, 90% sometimes. One phrase that I've heard used a lot more now than in previous cycles is stretch senior. You guys don't necessarily do that in the way some other people do it, but you're comfortable on some deals lending higher up. What makes you more comfortable in doing that, and what about a deal can allow it to underwrite that way without having to stack ProMark on top of it or something else?
Yeah, I would call the 0 to 90 as a, you know, that is a specific product for a specific client. I would call that a full stack lending as opposed to stretch senior. You know, it's priced like a senior piece and a mezz piece. So it's one loan with two notes, the A and the B note. We don't sell off the A to leverage up on the B note. That's a client-specific thing. What we like, that tends to be shorter duration development deals. It's great for industrial product. For certain markets of industrial that we really like, that's a perfect real estate product for that particular client, for that particular program. In some of the key industrial markets, aside from the LAs, the New Yorks, and say the Chicagos, some of the other, so I'll call it markets, 4 through 8, 4 through 10, the ones we really like, we think that's a great product for it. So we like it for in the right market with the right sponsor, for sure. We really like it because it's duration. It's usually going to be 12 to 24 month money.
Is that harder to apply to office because it just takes longer to build it?
For sure.
Have you done much on the
trickier execution? We do it for office, but we do it for build-a-suit.
Okay.
So if for the right credit, the right yield on cost, we would go up to 95% financing.
15-year lease?
Typically, yeah. It could be maybe 7, again, depending on the credit, but nothing less than 7. Just adding on to, I also do a lot of mezzanine debt as well, at least I'm trying to. And I think the challenge, there are some regulatory challenges for sure, which we'll probably touch on later. But I think the challenge that I find is that, we're not getting squeezed out by the senior. That space, we're getting squeezed out by just JV equity. If you're going 85% of the stack, the sponsors typically, for them to raise 15%, they're going out and having to raise that equity outside mm-hmm. of their institution, right? So if they're going to raise, 10 of the 15%, they're going to de-risk the project and raise, instead of 15% of total, they're gonna raise 35%, right? So it might not look underwrite as well to their return, but it's certain the risk return for a lot of these sponsors, they'd rather just raise the equity if they're gonna go out and raise it anyways, raise the full equity stack if they're gonna.
We've seen so much equity sometimes wanna write a bigger check that it's hard to find projects that are big enough, even in the office space. We're looking at a deal that's just over $100 million right now on a development deal. And the biggest problem the sponsor is having is they want to go with the kind of higher LTV senior because it makes the returns better on the spreadsheet, on the screen. But it's hard to find the equity guy that only wants to put in $10 million. It's easier to find the equity guy that wants to put in 20 to 30. And so that's, Matt, I think where you start to get squeezed sometimes because that equity guy says, I'd actually rather come down further and de-risk a little bit and write a bigger check because they're trying to get money out the door.
That's true, but our mezz is really also geared to doing about $5 to $15 million mezz, so we're doing smaller projects that are not going to attract an institutional money that I can go to JP Morgan and try to get $25 million out of a project. So these are individuals who are going to want to put another $10 to $15 million total equity in something. So it just kind of fits on a different bite size.
Okay. Tim, you're not a lender. You're the pure equity guy.
Right.
Nothing you guys do involves lending. So at least not in any way I would normally categorize it. There's some hybrids. We'll skip that. As an owner right now, would you rather build or buy?
It depends on the market, I think, a little bit. And we're doing a lot of both. These days, we're investing we're in the middle of investing an $800 million value fund and we're starting up a $600 million core fund that I spend most of my time on. And in both of those activities, we'll see new construction and we'll see, a lot of existing product. We probably have maybe 7 or 8 million square feet of industrial being built around the country now. But it depends on the market. So where you're not getting paid for the risk when the cap rates are getting low in certain places, we'd rather build and take that risk and get paid appropriately for taking that risk in those locations. We're sort of deal junkies, and we're always looking at different ways to skin a cat. Since this is sort of more of an office topic, maybe 10% of the money we've raised in the value fund will go into office. And for instance, we just did a deal down in Charlotte where we found like an 80s vintage building, four-story building. We stripped it down to the concrete, reskinned it, all new equipment, put in you know, amenities, a health club, and some food service and that sort of thing. Wells was the tenant in the building, but when we bought it, they moved out because the building didn't work for them. A year later, after we built the thing, Wells showed up again and said, "Boy, this building's perfect for us," and moved back in and did a 13-year lease, which we then, you know, we had maybe $100 into the building, and we sold it for $250 a foot. You know, so. Because, you know, those types of deals you like talking about, but we've probably done that, you know, 7 or 8 times around the country. And so, you know, building in that context is pretty fun. You get terrific debt, and it really generates some great equity returns.
So. Where do you see office for the stuff you look at, office in the cycle compared to industrial right now?
Well, I think there's two office markets, right? There's, you know, a downtown market and a suburban market. And, you know, it seems, you know, everybody hears about the trends of the office, you know, the flood of people going downtown. And so I see industrial being between the two, industrial is so solid everywhere. Almost everywhere we're going, we're pushing rents everywhere we are. Occupancy's up across the board. You're starting to see construction, but not so much that's going to affect rents, or, you know, negatively affect rents. So I love the industrial space now, and actually I think there's probably plenty of opportunity in suburban office because there's not as much demand there, and I think it's going to come back. So I don't know if that answers your question, but
well, let me focus on suburban office for a second then. So last month, Newmark, Grubb, Knight, Frank came out with a study that they say that between 14% and 22% of the U.S. suburban office inventory, which, by the way, translates to 600 million to 1 billion square feet of space. That's 7.5% of the entire office stock of the United States of America, is in some stage of obsolescence. And we've heard a bunch over the recent years about the downfall of suburban office. Suburban office has a significantly higher vacancy rate than the CBDs do. What do we do with all this office space we have in the suburbs? Can it be turned into something, or do some of these buildings become ghost buildings someday? Open, whoever wants to volley on that.
Well, there's, it's all real estate's locals, right? Austin suburban office is a whole lot different than Chicago suburban office. Austin can have C properties and they're well located. They're always gonna be leased in Austin, Texas, just there's demand. Chicago is certainly, you've seen the flight from the suburbs to the CBD. It's driven by the fact young educated people do not wanna drive out to the suburbs. They can't do that efficiently. And I believe Chicago suburbs are effectively dead from an office standpoint. We would never invest in Chicago office in the suburbs.
At any price?
No, at any price. Okay. A lot of it should just be knocked down. And it will be knocked down.
Right. It's so easier to repurpose in downtown, too, because we can find a way to...
Yeah, what's funny about that, right? 10 to 15 years ago, brick and beam was terrible stuff that people didn't want to go into. Now it's all the creative office everybody wants.
Right.
But there's no real brick and beam in, you know, Lyle, Illinois, I don't believe.
Tim, you were going to say something?
No, I wonder what happens when those young people who insist on being downtown, you know, have kids and, you know, there's no educational option other than very expensive private schools, you know, in this town. I'm sure that happens in a lot of, you know, New York and San Francisco and LA. You know, so you don't have a choice but to relocate and then you want to be in the burbs. And so I think it might be a population bubble that's causing this trend now. That to say that it's dead, I think, is maybe it's dead for now, would be my take.
Rob, you had a thought?
What I was thinking is that, you know, we looked at suburban office building on Lake Hook Road up in Northbrook, decent mark. Well, actually, it was on the north side of the street, so it was Deerfield. The building was so far gone that you couldn't use it for office anymore, because you could either buy it and kind of try to lease it as is, and you get real low rents and real, you know, high turnover type tenants. And if you wanted to go for a better tenant, the amount of money you would have to put in to fix this building up, the return that you'd get from the rents that you get wouldn't work for you. So what we wanted to do was buy the building and knock it down, but the owner hadn't yet come to terms with the fact that he had this problem building. So it's something that we're watching, but a building like that is, I agree, I think is dead for right now, because it really needs to be scraped and redeveloped. And a lot of the owners, you know, see the prices that are being paid and they think that, you know, they should participate.
You buy distressed debt. Is your play ultimately, do you think, to be buying this from lenders when the wheels completely fall off on those owners?
Well, we were very, very active in buying distressed debt from late 2008 to, you know, 2013. There's not much, you know, in the way of distressed debt right now. At least we aren't seeing it, and we went from devoting principally all of our time to the debt business, and now we've gone back to buying real estate and, you know, making loans. It remains to be seen what happens with all the CMBS maturities that come. We kind of thought, you know, when you're looking at it in 2008 and you were looking at the, you know, the 13, 14, 15, which there was lots of maturities, you know, not as much as 16 and 17, but still a huge amount of loans matured, and you're like, wow, there'll be all sorts of opportunities to buy these loans as they mature, and the special servicers won't know what to do, and, you know, it's gonna be great. It hasn't played out that way because values have come back, and, you know, there was something today in the paper that values are back to where they were pre-recession. So, and the CMBS world is as healthy and as active and as aggressive as they were as far as volumes, except that they are really underwriting now instead of, you know, 2007, you know, you had five CMBS lenders fighting for your deal, and you were closing 30 days later, and you were kind of spinning, your head was spinning, saying they don't really know anything about what they're buying, what they're lending on. Now the lenders really make you jump through the hoops, and they really do the work. But there's so much money and there's so much competition that, you know, they are aggressively looking to lend on the things that they want to lend on.
Had this discussion with Dale Shonsky, who's the president of NAI, and Jeff Woodward, who's the president of C3 that owns NAI. And Jeff and C3 are the largest special servicer in the U.S., I believe, right now. And Jeff's belief is that, looking at their own pipeline, that the next 2 years they have still a lot of inventory to come through their system, but that the deals are going to start to be much bigger deals. They're not going to be the $2 million and $5 million and $10 million deals. They're going to be the $80 million and the $120 and the $200 million deals. Are you starting to see some of that, or is that still to make it to the market at this point?
We haven't really seen that, but I don't really play in the nine-figure world.
It's, right.
I'm in the, you know, the $5 to $20 million world is kind of where we focus our efforts.
And at this point, do you think that level of debt distress is mostly gone there?
Presently, yes, it's definitely mostly gone. The distress loans that are still out there that the lenders are trying to sell, to me, fall in one of two categories. It's either so bad that you don't want it basically at any price, or, you know, they put it out on the market and someone pays them 98 cents for it, and, you know, at least from my perspective, there's not a good risk-reward, a risk-reward equilibrium being made by the buyer of that.
There's a few of them in Chicago now, towers that have CMBS issues that are either in default and going Wacker Drive, and we can all look at one. 123 North Wacker, that's no secret. That's been in special servicing and went through
bankruptcy. And that's TIC owned still, right?
That's
one of the triple net deals?
Yes. But there's a couple other ones that are in some capacity being recapitalized. The issue is there's enough money out there that these will be recapitalized. There's enough debt to get to a value, and then there's plenty of equity out there. A few years ago, you would have thought there's not enough dry powder. There's more than enough dry powder to deal with all these looming maturities.
So while you might not be able to replace the debt, you can still sell the building for above what the debt balance is, so you're still going to have a transaction somehow occur. It's just going to be a reshuffling of what the stack looks like in the new ownership.
Yeah, it's the tough ones are the ones that are kind of right around value, and the equity doesn't want to let it go, so they want to recap it. But no, there's plenty. You can sell it, and if you're going to take a loss on that paper, you can certainly cobble together an equity stack that everybody would be somewhat happy with. There's plenty of money out there.
Yeah, when 3 years ago we were sizing debt packages across pools of industrial for, you know, like 40 to 50 million, thinking that we get the most action at that size range, and we've upped that to 80 to 100 now. Because if we take an industrial package out between 50 and 65% leverage, we'll get 15, 20 lenders fighting over it, and the spreads we're getting, you know, interest-only debt the whole time, and it's, you know, 160 to 180 over the 10-year. I mean, it's free money.
Makes it easy to make those returns work on the spreadsheet again.
Yeah.
Rob, you touched on kind of second, third tier markets for a second. How much are all of you active in second and third tier markets, and how much are you seeing money truly migrate? My personal site has been that we've heard about the migration towards second and third tier markets for the last couple of years, and that money's going to go start chasing yield, but we haven't seen it come as strongly as people might have predicted. Or I don't know how some of the people in this audience I know are from second and third tier markets, and I hear frequently from some of them, when is all this money coming my way to my market?
I still think that, you know, someone up here said real estate's local, so I don't know about making a macro statement about where the money is headed, but there are good deals to be done in, you know, tertiary cities. It's harder to find them, and it's harder to understand what they are if you're sitting in Chicago. But we're certainly happy to look at things in the secondary and tertiary markets. One of the best deals we did in the last couple of years was buying a hotel in Greenville, and, you know, we've gotten plenty of institutional offers of people that want to buy the hotel, and we had no shortage of lenders that wanted to finance the hotel. So
right.
I think there's, you know, I don't have experience in like the real small places, but I think if you're in the Greenville type markets, you can find good deals, and you can find, you know, money and lenders that are willing to go there.
Rafi, will you guys go there?
Yes. So, you know, when we're going to secondary, particularly tertiary markets, we're taking less real estate risk to go in those markets. So build-to-suit type of opportunities with good credit, you know, like I said, 10-year lease terms, things like that, we will go in those markets. But, you know, on the risk-return spectrum, we're dialing down the real estate risk to take the market risk, if you will.
And are you requiring leases in place in a different way? Are you requiring lower LTV in the stack and more equity? How are you dialing that risk down?
Leases in place.
Okay.
These are, yeah, build-to-suit opportunities to go in tertiary markets for sure. You know, we'll go in that sort of full stack development financing program. We'll go to 90%, right, for the right tenant, you know, with the right sponsor and the right economic structure. But in terms of just, you know, Heitman does most of its businesses on the equity side. Core investing is probably 75% of our business, of our AUM is core equity investing. And, you know, from the client side, the pension fund side, they're not going there. I mean, that they're still looking at, you know, they'll go to New York and pay a 3-something cap, right? They're still core focused. They'll pay the extra whatever it takes to get that deal that they really want. And so that is the 2 years I've been back from Europe, that has been a prevailing sort of theme.
Do you think that's taking longer to happen than it did in the last cycle?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
One of the things that I think we saw in the last cycle was there was a point, and arguably that was 2006, 2007, right before everything fell apart. There was a point at which I think kind of my own canary in the coal mine description would be, there was a point at which the difference in pricing between second and third tier markets and first tier markets kind of got squeezed down to a very small amount. Some of that was a tick market phenomenon because that particular product needed yield, and so they would chase it in just about anywhere. Are we not seeing that compression? I think it's about wrongly pricing risk in second and third tier markets, and I'm not sensing that we're seeing that yet.
I still think people are chasing yield, and that's why they're going to the second and third tertiary markets. I don't play in the pension fund world in the core assets, so I understand what Rafi's saying. But for kind of the more opportunistic investors, you know, it's hard to find a deal in New York where you can pro forma, you know, the same kind of yield that you can if you look at a deal in Milwaukee. And maybe the deal in Milwaukee is still a good deal worth doing, but it's in Milwaukee.
Tim?
Well, we're invested in 40 markets, which I'd kind of characterize as all the primary markets and all the secondary markets, but none of the tertiary markets. So, you know, we'll go to all the you know, mid-sized markets around the country. And we're investing pension fund money, and our investors certainly, you know where we are and what we're doing there. They would prefer that we had a weighting towards the, you know, the top tier markets, but they're comfortable with what we're doing in the second, and mostly because what we're doing in the second is we're getting a little extra yield, but we're not taking a lot of extra risk because we're buying high quality buildings. And, you know, if we're going to buy a lower quality building, it's going to be in one of the better markets. And in general, you know, we've got pretty high standards in terms of what kind of buildings we're buying. But I would say that there's a pretty wide spread between, you know, where what you can buy something in LA and what you could buy something in, you know, San Antonio, Texas is, you know, it's pretty wide at the moment.
Are you seeing more supply growth constraint in second and third tier markets than you are in the primary markets right now?
Supply of product?
The supply growth, yeah. Building new.
I don't know.
Is that protecting second and third tier markets better right now?
I think there's like 6 or 7 million square foot buildings going up on spec in Dallas, and you know there's not a single spec building going up. Or I guess there's one spec building going up in Memphis. Yeah, so there's a lot of new product going up in the, you know, the kind of the five primary markets.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Peter, you guys don't really care where it is, though, right?
Anywhere in the country, anywhere we have a footprint, which is pretty much
much everywhere.
Yeah.
So you look at this differently than most of the guys up here.
Yeah, we'll do deals everywhere. We don't, you know, we're pretty much a nationwide bank. We are nationwide. The only place I think we might not have a great coverage area is Hawaii. And I know Rick Bonito, I think you're working on that, right? You want to be able to cover that market? And Puerto Rico too. Yeah. So yeah, we'll do deals everywhere.
How many of you are doing floating rate versus fixed rate when you're doing lending side? Matt, you want to start? And how do you view the risk of the potential for interest rate rise in deals right now? How are you addressing that?
Well, it really comes down to what the sponsor is looking for. I mean, obviously a transition asset, they're going to want some floating. So we'll do floating mezz, you know, that's, you know, 2 to 4 year paper, but we'll also do, you know, longer term paper that's fixed because the leases are in place. You know, we just financed a industrial portfolio in secondary and tertiary markets, and that's fixed rate paper to go along with the fixed rate senior. So it just depends what the sponsor wants. We're fine with either.
Does that tend to price in about the same all-in pricing range, or does one have an advantage over the other?
The float's cheaper.
And what is
a little bit cheaper.
And in terms of exit, you said transitional assets. So what about a transitional asset makes the floating rate more attractive other than a little bit lower coupon?
Well, because they're not going to be stuck with the yield maintenance and the flexibility to get out.
So the point is, by not locking it in, you can walk away.
Yeah.
When you lock it in, you also have to protect somebody's return.
Yeah, we'll have yield maintenance on that. So you may do a great job in 2 to 3 years, but you're going to have to pay me, you know, a fair amount of a penalty to get out early.
Got it. Rob, you guys do mostly floating when you're doing debt stuff, right?
Right. All the loans that we make are floating rate loans, and they're primarily all 1 to 3 year. So there's not a fixed rate. Everything we do is kind of in transition or time constrained, and that's why we're the lender. So we don't deal in the fixed rate world.
Do you require borrowers to get some kind of a hedge?
No.
Do you find borrowers wanting to do that anyway, or are they just comfortable with interest rate risk at this point?
You know, what we'll do sometimes, because our interest rates are, you know, we float over prime and our interest rate is high, sometimes I'll have a floor, but there'll be room in the margin for prime to go up before the floor goes up. And because, you know, our interest rates are, you know, our floor is high, it's kind of, there's room and everyone, they can feel comfortable for a year or 2 years that the rate's not going to change on them.
Okay. Talk about kind of balance of power in negotiations for a minute. Whether you view it as a, Tim, you want to talk about it as a landlord versus tenant, and then maybe we'll talk from the lending side for our lenders about borrower versus lender and kind of how that world is today.
Well, from the landlord tenant, for the longest time, it was, you know, keeping your buildings filled and you know, tenants making, taking a long time to make decisions and feeling they're in the catbird seat. And I would say that's, you know, flipped now where we have, you know, more than one prospect and most of the time looking at individual spaces and they're in a hurry to tie it up before they lose it because they just lost one. And a lot of tenants have had that experience of not getting the space they wanted because they waited too long or now. So it's a different dynamic. And we're generally, you know, inching up rent everywhere that we own product, and it's good to be a landlord these days. From the lending side, you know, it's interesting where you have such huge competition to, you know, we're doing fixed and floating, and either side, there's a lot of competition that we create for the lenders for wanting to lend on, you know, basically reasonably new, pretty well leased industrial, which everybody wants. And it's interesting that once that, you know, letter of intent signer, the APIS, you know, or that, you know, we've made a deal with somebody, the lenders aren't acting any differently. Or they aren't acting like they need the deal more than you do. You know, kind of it seems to be fairly equal in terms of the negotiation of the documents. And I think they've got all kinds of restrictions now and restraints in terms of what they can agree to and what they can't. So there's a lot of discipline on the lender side, which I think is, you know, healthy in the end. So,
Rob, on the lender side to it with the borrower, how much do you feel that push and pull? Is there, are we in balance, kind of everybody's got the same interest, or do you feel one side has a little bit of an upper hand right now?
I think it completely depends on what, you know, where the property is, what the property is, and, you know, if you have something that's desirable, you will have lots of lenders and they'll negotiate hard to get your deal. I did chuckle because after you sign up a term sheet and you send your money to the lender, you're no longer, you know, you're just like everyone else. And they do make you, like I said before, they do make you jump through all the underwriting hoops, and they are doing a thorough underwriting job these days, which is a good thing. But it makes closing loans, it's work, and it's, you know, it doesn't go fast usually, and you have to work at it. Conversely, if you have a property that's in a tertiary market, or it's an asset class that people don't like, or you have a asset that's not doing great, you know, you're working hard to find a lender, you know, to find a lender that wants to make a deal with you, and you have to play by their rules when you find them.
I assume too, if you do some deals with very short fuse on them.
Yes.
And I'm assuming, without being a jerk about it in any way, at some point you're saying, hey, if we need to get through loan documents and close this deal, we aren't going to have time to go back and forth 8 times.
When I'm the lender, when my company's the lender and I'm doing something like, you know, people come and they need to close in 10 days because whatever the circumstance was, you know, I always give the speech, you know, we'll send the loan documents and we'll go back and forth one time, and that's going to be it if you want to close. There's not time to have protracted negotiations, and, you know, I'll get you to the closing table and I'll make this deal for you, but there's not a lot of margin for, you know, lots of negotiations and changing lots of terms because, you know, you truly don't have time for it.
We did a deal with our dear friend Bill Burgess here that we did in 10 days recently, and I think we got a few things changed on our loan document, but we definitely didn't have more than, we did the deal in 8 days. 8 days, start to finish, to closing, with an absolute hard stop. Deal evaporated with a foreclosure on it if we didn't get it done. And we did do one turn of a loan document, but we knew anything they gave us back was out of politeness because we didn't have really a choice if they said no. Yeah. Rafi, what do you think?
Well, you know, completely agree with the colleagues on the panel. I think once you do get a term sheet signed up, you know, the dynamic does change a little bit. You know, it's interesting when you're a mezz lender, you feel the pull from both sides. So I'm currently doing a deal where, you know, you have to negotiate the intercreditor with the senior loan, senior lender, and as soon as you start doing that, you feel, you know, you're in that rock fight with the senior lender, and at the same time, you're in the rock fight with the sponsor on your mezz loan agreement. So it's just a process. But yeah, there's so much capital out there up until the point you have a signed term sheet. You know, certainly the borrower, I'd say for the most part, is, you know, kind of pulling the strings. But once you get into documentation and negotiating that, I generally speaking, the lender, whether it's the mezz lender or the senior lender, has the upper hand for the most part.
For the benefit of the audience that doesn't deal with stacked funding and mezz loan on top of a senior, talk just for a second about just what is an intercreditor and how does that come into play? Because that will affect the deal and it'll affect timing for a lender and a borrower.
Yeah, it very simply, and you know, chime in please, it very simply, it just kind of sets the ground rules by which the senior lender and the mezz lender play by if there were certain things that were to happen to the sponsor, right? So, you know, if they're in default, the sponsor's in default, it allows the mezz lender their rights to cure a default, for instance. Who they can bring in as the operator, who can't they bring in as the operator? Can the mezz lender, you know, assign their interest, sell their interest, for instance? Who to? Do they have to be qualified and whatnot? So basically, before you ink the deal, it sets the ground rules. That's probably the best way.
You've all talked a little bit about how long it can take once it gets into the, I'll call it the back room with the green visor guys, once you've signed that term sheet. Some of you guys have regulators, some of you don't. You want to talk a little bit about the difference and how you think it affects your kind of your process? I'm going to start with the most heavily regulated guy here, and that's Peter.
The regulatory environment has definitely changed. But the good thing is, if you're a qualified borrower, there are a lot of options in terms of folks out there financing. And we have to jump through a few more hoops, dot a few more I's and cross a few more T's. But the good thing is there's a lot of available money out there, very cheap money, and we're proud to say we're in that game. So, but one of the things in particular you see a lot more on the regulatory side is we also do interest rate protection. We do interest rate swaps, derivatives. So that's where we've seen a lot more in terms of regulatory environment. In terms of, for instance, I can't even quote a rate on a swap. I'm not licensed. So to quote a fixed rate for a client, we need to get somebody on the phone from our swap desk. So that's an example of a change that came as a result of Dodd-Frank. The good thing is we're still out making deals, and we're making a lot of them. So it's a good time to be a borrower, especially if you're well-qualified.
Who wants to take it as a non-regulated team, and what you think that means to you?
We're completely non-regulated, so I'm just trying to, you know, think through the issues and make smart decisions. And, you know, I can go as fast or as slow as I want to go. And, you know, basically I have to answer to, you know, my partners, and my partners have to answer to me and our investors, and that's the full circle.
Rafi, you're not regulated, but some of your investors in your fund are regulated in different ways.
Yeah, I'll
go ahead.
Comment on something else, and I can get to that. You know, we're not regulated, but I think the regulatory environment is definitely affecting us. So the concept of, or the Basel III, there's a regulation out there called HVCRE, High Volatility Commercial Real Estate Lending, and essentially, these regulated banks, and I forget what the test is, it's some certain AUM of the bank, you know, they're not.
By the way, let me cut you off for one second. AUM, for anybody who doesn't deal with that, assets under management.
You know, the test is that there has to be 15% cash equity in the deal, so you can't over leverage. So as a mezz lender, it's sometimes we get pinched in a way. So, you know, if we wanted to go up to 90%, for instance, on a particular opportunity, the senior lender cannot lend in that capital structure. So we would have to come down to 85%. And some banks are just saying no to mezz altogether, right? So you have to morph into more of a pref equity or just a straight JV equity structure.
And that regulation doesn't just affect the senior lender's loan. It affects the entire capital stack. They look at the whole thing, no matter how high they go.
Exactly.
They still say nobody can call anything in this capital stack deck, call it debt, above 85%, right?
Exactly.
When your senior lender is a regulated entity.
The senior lender could be 60% or 50% even, right? But it's the total stack. That's how they look at it.
Matt, how do you look at the difference between pref and mez in those situations? Is this just, I mean, there's times when we've kind of said this is just a game.
It's just, that's just words. Some pref equity, we can make our mez pref equity, but, you know, we're going to get, you know, a pledge of the equity interest. So if they default, we can take over, effectively just take the equity, and we're in control. And we'll get a recognition agreement instead of an intercreditor agreement with a lender that would allow us to do certain things if the equity defaults.
Without tripping any covenants that
Correct.
The loan would
that
have
we,
on
we can
transfer
on the
transfers
property
otherwise.
To us, et cetera. So, but, yeah, it's not called MES at that point.
Okay.
But it's the same. It has the same control features.
All right.
Now, some people, pref equity is also just in the equity stack as well. And to us, we're blind to that LLC is just equity coming in. And that sponsor may raise it on a pref standpoint and just paying a set interest rate to that guy. We have no idea what happens there. But our MES can be called pref equity, but it's always going to be lower in the stack and not in the equity portion of it.
All right. We've got about 7 minutes left. So rather than me asking a couple more questions, there's a microphone we can pass around, but Bill, you've got a loud enough voice, so we'll start with him.
Yeah, that would already be in what?
Do you write your documentation in a way that it's already subordinate to the A lender's language?
We're always going to be subordinate within our piece, but it would be in the recognition agreement with the senior that we would be able to take that equity. It's really just a stock certificate sitting in our attorney's office.
Kathy?
So this is fascinating, except can you talk a little bit about it? How this translates over the next couple of years with the impact actually on tenants. So in my market in Philadelphia, my experience this last year is doing tenant rep is getting bounced around from building to building to building, no matter how much somebody wants to pay. Prices keep going up very quickly, and it's really difficult to kind of educate my clients about what's happening with lending and how it affects their office space, what their leases can look like. So is this just going to keep prices go up? Everything's going to get tighter and tighter. Any new buildings getting built anywhere? Can you talk a little bit more about what's going to happen in the next couple of years?
From
your view of the world.
Let me generalize that maybe just a little bit. How much should a tenant care who their landlord's lender is, and what do they need to? What are the hot buttons they need to be thinking about? Because that it sounds like you're finding some of your tenants are getting hit with problems that are really coming from the lender side.
They could care less who the lender is. They just want to be able to rent space at a reasonable rate, and not 1 year pay $22 a foot, and the next year the same space is $27, and then a year later it goes up to $30. So that's
well, you're in Philly. You're actually in a pretty good spot. Your tenants in San Francisco would have a real problem. So. But no, the fundamentals are moving to the side of it's the landlord controls, and rents are going up, and fundamentals are good, and there's a lot of demand out there, so rents are always going to be going up, or certainly going to be going up in the next couple of years. I mean, we're on the equity side, and we're on the mezz lending side. Every property we own, whether it be office, industrial, retail, rents are moving up.
I think the issue is that rents are going up because there's supply demand is in the landlord's favor, and there's not a lot of construction going on, and it's mostly because the lenders aren't rushing in to over lend on spec development in any product type, really, except for I think there's healthy demand wherever that spec is going on. So until there's supply starts catching up with the demand, you're going to keep seeing rents going up.
And generally, even though rents go up, so it's harder for tenants, I think as an industry, it's that stability of not overbuilding is generally considered by most of us a healthy thing, right? The roller coaster of rocket ship and crash is not necessarily any better for a tenant, or certainly not better for the investment world.
What's the issue with the suburbs here in Chicago, like compared to Dallas, that are doing great, you know, overall with Plano and all that, and Dallas? What's the issue with the suburban markets here?
Well, if I'm, I don't know, if I'm 25, there's probably a few different areas I could live in Dallas and drive pretty easily to work. If I'm 25, I don't want to live and work in Lyle. I want to live downtown, and I want to work downtown. It's harder to move around. So Chicago's a 24/7 city. Dallas doesn't really have that. They have pockets of that.
And there's been a steady stream of big companies moving big operations downtown, and it's draining the suburbs. And so it's really it's not, you know, small users that are deciding to be down there. It's, you know, McDonald's is talking about, or there's rumors about them moving downtown, and they're the most suburban of office tenant you could imagine, but they're talking about it too. So
they've been based in Oak Brook for 30, 40 years,
yeah.
I think.
Okay.
50.
Okay, you're from Dallas?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other questions?
Are they moving downtown? The company is moving downtown because we can't find the employees they need in the suburbs. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Young professionals. Correct.
So, question. Maybe it's for Peter on the derivatives or the interest rate swaps. Yeah, I mean, a lot of this is stuff I don't deal with regularly, but it seems like you need a participant on each side. So, who's on the other side of the swap that is effectively betting that rates are going to go down? Because most people, I mean, they're pretty damn low. Is there somebody betting that they're going to go down? Is that how a swap kind of works?
Well, it's a marketable instrument, so it's a trade. It's traded, so there's going to be a willing buyer and seller on both sides of the trade. So I don't want to say that somebody necessarily betting against it, but it's a marketable security, so people buy, invest in that fixed rate that we use as a hedge when somebody buys a, for instance, piece of real estate. The way a swap basically works is we would make a underlying variable rate loan to our client, and then we would work with our swap desk to actually be able to layer on top of that a separate instrument that actually fixes the rate and the payment for the client.
So the word swap is partly a good word and partly a confusing word, maybe, in the sense. So you're swapping in that you're taking a variable rate, moving around interest rate, and you're converting it into a fixed rate because of this event. But you're not trading like a barter, even up, that he's betting it goes up and you're betting it's going down. You're going to pay for that swap. And you're paying, and so what the question really becomes is, what is the cost? What is that, whoever's taking the other end of that risk, how much is it worth for that amount of loan amount that they're looking at the risk on? How much do they need to charge you for them taking your interest rate risk instead of you taking your interest rate risk? And you pay them on day one. And then, as Peter said, it's a marketable security. So as rates move around, they can get in and out of that, and they can sell it on. Peter can sell it to Matt, can sell it to me, can sell it to you if we need to. Other questions? All right, I'll ask one more in closing then, just quick answer from everybody on the panel. Are we at the, and in the cycle here, are we at the end of the beginning or the beginning of the end?
Since I got the mic, I'd say we're probably in the sixth inning.
Rob?
Yeah, I think that we're closer to the beginning of the end than the end of the beginning. Same.
Okay. I got to make you answer, Matt.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the next couple years will be pretty good for U.S. commercial real estate. Certainly the next 12 months.
Were you trained as an economist?
Yes.
Nice.
It feels to me like it's, you know, seventh inning, but it's probably going to go 13 or 14 innings.
Right? Wow. Okay.
Let's hope so.
Everyone in this room likes that answer.
Yeah.
Rafi, you're up.
I'd say the end of the beginning.
Okay.
Yeah. I still think there's a little room to run.
Unless anybody's got any other questions, I think we're one more here. Well, I know the Chinese love the number eight, so the more Chinese money that comes in, maybe that does extend us into the 13th, 14th inning. Thank you, panelists, very much for your time today, everybody.